Okay. It's Parshas Tetzaveh. Yep. And we're going to dedicate the shiur today for the... Yeah, we're good. Today's shiur is going to be dedicated to the neshama of Avraham and you can seal Yehuda. Your tzitz in a few days, right?
Sunday.
Yud Beis, yeah?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you give Yud Beis, yeah. Yud Beis Adar, so neshama shav and aliyah, and only good things. So today we actually do a shiur on Purim. So I put the chumashim out because the Megillah is there, but I'll give you the page in a second. But actually, it is connected to the parsha, so I'll just connect to the parsha because we shouldn't escape a little bit of the parsha at least. So just explain the connection. The connection is very simple. Good morning. The connection is very simple. The connection is that this parsha, Parshas Tetzaveh, primarily talks about the Bigdei Kehuna, the garments of the Kohen, the four garments of every Kohen, of every priest, and also the eight garments of the Kohen Gadol, right, the high priest. Now, what's the connection to Purim? Anyone else? Garments of the Kohen Gadol, the Purim?
No?
The connection is very simple. At the beginning of the, it's a medrash, the beginning of the Purim story, the Megillah begins with Ahasuerus' feast, right? Why did he make that feast? He made that feast because one of the things Ahasuerus was very... He was, on one level, he was relatively okay with the Jews, because in other words, they lived in relative comfort in the Persian exile. But Ahasuerus was extremely nervous about the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, because he thought it would undermine his empire. And he knew that there was a nevuah, there was a prophecy that was given to the Jewish people when the first temple was destroyed, the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, that they were going to Golus Bava, they were going to the Babylonian exile for 70 years. And he was very worried that soon the 70 years are up and they would return to the Eretz Yisrael with their own sovereign land and would have a Beis HaMikdash. Now, the problem was that it wasn't the calculation of the 70 years wasn't clear. And the reason for that is because when the Jewish people went into exile after the first temple, after the first Beis HaMikdash, they went in stages. Right? There was a number of different, part of the nation was exiled first, then another part, and some of the leaders were exiled, then some other leaders, right? So he made a calculation, and he came to the calculation, a mistaken calculation, that the 7 years are up, Jews are still in his land, they haven't gone back to the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore he figured, well, that's it, it's over, Hashem has forgotten about his people, the Nevuah, the prophecy, no longer applies, and we can be at comfort, which is why he threw this big party, threw this big banquet, right, to actually celebrate what he believed was the permanence and the stability of his empire, right? Now we know that one of the wrongdoings that the Jewish people did is that they went to this party and that they not only went to but they enjoyed it. The expression in the Gemara is Nehenu Misudose Shel Achashverosh. They derived pleasure. They actually immersed themselves. They really got a lot of hanah, a lot of pleasure from that party. But part of it, the Midrashim explained, was the following. Because if you look in the Megillah, it says that he threw this amazing banquet. And there was all these amazing tapestries and curtains, the kelim mikelim shoinim, and there was a variety of different vessels, which the Gemara says actually meant vessels from the Beis HaMikdash, right? And the Yidden saw that, and then they weren't sensitive to it enough. But there's another medrash that says that Ahasuerus actually at that banquet got dressed in the garments of the Kohen Gadol, right? Sorry, yeah. You're dressed in the garments of the Kohen Gadol. And that sort of added to the problem of actually being there, right? The fact that he was parading around, it was such a blatant thing, right? By the way, there's a reference to that whole problem with Ahasuerus later on in the Megillah also. You know, when Esther comes to him and he reaches out with a scepter and he asks her, what do you want? And he said, Maloch Esther Amalka, what can I do for you? At chatzi hamalchus v'seos, until, and he says it a few times. By the banquet also, he says, tell me what you want, I'll give you up to half the kingdom. Right? What does he mean up to half the kingdom? Why don't you just say, I'll give you whatever you want, right? So Chazal said there was a bit of subconscious language there. That he said, I'll give you everything. I mean, when I say subconscious, because he didn't consciously know she was Jewish at that point, but he was saying, I'll give you everything ad chatzi, until half, which means I'll give you something, but I won't give you something that's going to chatzi, that's going to halve my kingdom, that's going to split my kingdom, i.e. the Beis HaMikdash, that I will not permit you to have, right? Everything else you can have. So there's this role reference to this issue. Later on, of course, just to complete the story before we get into what I want to do today, later on, of course, Darius, in other words, he made a mistake with the 70 years. 70 years weren't up yet. 70 years were from the destruction of the actual temple, weren't up yet, and was later on that Daryovesh, which some say was his, well, it was his son, but some say it was Esther's son, actually. It was a child they had together, Esther and Ahasuerus, who might have been technically Jewish, but he was the Persian king. He actually gave permission for the Jews to go back to Israel and for the Beis HaMikdash to be built. And Ezra, that was when Ezra and Nehemiah went back to Israel and they built the second temple. Not actually undermining the kingdom of Persia at all, really, because the second Beis HaMikdash was interesting that the Jews were able to return to Israel, but they didn't have a sovereign land completely. They were still under the Persian rule, really. So that was interesting. So that happened in the rule of Daryovish. But this is the connection between the banquet and Purim. Okay. Having said that, let's move to the Megillah. So I want to actually focus on a particular part of the Megillah. It's page 1257. It's a few very dramatic psukim, beautiful psukim, and I wanted to just go into something over there, which is very fascinating. I mean, there's so much to go into, all parts of the Megillah, but this is one part. So again, 1257. So the Megillah, the context is this. The context is, it's Esther has been summoned by Mordechai to go and intervene on the Jews' behalf. Esther says, I cannot do that because I wasn't called to the king. Mordechai says, you have to, that's why you were put there. And she goes, she says, I will go, but on one condition. Go and gather all the Jewish people, fast for 3 days. Don't eat, don't drink. Incidentally, I think I might have mentioned this last year, those 3 days covered the first night of Pesach, so they actually didn't have, the Jews of Shushan did not have a Seder that year. They didn't eat matzah, they didn't drink wine. And she said, on the third day, I will go to the king. She does. Excuse me, she goes to the king, and he says, what do you want? And she says, I want you to come to a banquet, an individual banquet that I will make you, a private banquet that I'll make you for you and Haman, right? Comes to the first banquet. Haman is there. They have a great banquet. Ahasuerus turns to the middle and says, what can I do for you? So she says, Imal HaMelech Toiv, I want you to come tomorrow night for a second, tomorrow for a second banquet, and then I will tell you what I want, right? Okay. So what we're about to read takes place in the middle of the two parties, right? Haman walks out of the first party and he was really on top of the world. Okay, really on top of the world, right? So let's see. It's a page 1257, Pasuk Tes, verse 9. So it says, the Pasuk is like this. Vayetze Haman vayemahu. Haman went out on that day. Yeah, everyone has it? Page 1257, Pasuk Tes, okay. Haman went out on that day, someach v'toiv loiv, happy, good heart. He was on top of the world. But as soon as he saw Mordechai sitting at the gate of the king, because Mordechai was a dignitary and he sat at the gate of the palace, he wouldn't even get up for him. So Mordechai became filled with rage against Mordechai. By Sapak Haman, he restrained himself. Vayove el beis, and he came home. Vayishlach, and he sent. Vayove es oyavov, he brought all his very good friends. Vezeresh ishtoy, and Zeresh his wife. What happens? Vayisaper lem Haman is kvoid oshrei v'roiv bonav. Haman told them all the amazing honor and riches that he had. Children, he said, I've got everything. Vesasher gidloy hamelech, the fact that the king had promoted him. Vesasher nisoy al asorim, the fact that he promoted him ahead and higher than all the other dignitaries and ministers, v'avdei hamelech, and all other servants of the king. Then he says, Vayomer Haman. Haman says, you should know, just to give you an illustration of how high I have reached, af lehevio Esther amalkin hamelech asher el amishta asher asosa ki imoisi. And the queen has not invited anyone to the party that she made, except which she made with the king, except for me. And not only that, v'gam lemachar, and even tomorrow, ani koru lo im hamelech, I am invited again with the king for a private party with the queen. And then he says the most, we've spoken about this before, but the most amazing pasuk. He says, V'chol ze einenu shoyveli. This is all worth nothing to me. V'chol eis asher ani royas Mordechai Yehudi, as long as I see Mordechai the Jew, Yoshe b'shar ha-melech, sitting at the king. Amazing thing, right? He's got everything. He's got it all made, and that, but it's all worth nothing because one old Jew won't bow down to him. Okay, separate discussion. So now let's see what happens. V'toymer loy zeresh ishtoy. So Zeresh, his wife, said to him, and all his friends, Yasu eitz, let them make a gallow, eitz, out of wood, govoya chamishim amma, 50 ammas high. Ubaboyker, in the morning, early morning, emor lamelech, go and tell the king, interesting language, not ask the king, just tell the king, v'yislu es Mordechai olov, they will hang Mordechai on this gallow, right? Uvoy im hamelach, and then afterwards you can come with the king, el hamishta, to the banquet, to the party, someach, happy. Vayitav hadovar lifnei Haman. This was very good idea in Haman's eyes. Vayasu eitz, and he made the gallows that very night, and he went very early the next morning, as we read later in the Megillah, to execute his plan. Okay. So before we go into a very deep idea behind this whole thing, I want to just go into it a little bit. First of all, there's a fascinating medrash about a conversation that took place. You know, very often what happens is we have the gist of the conversation in the psukim, but the background story to the conversation we find in the medrash. So why do they make a gallows? I mean, there's different ways to kill Mordechai. Why a gallows? So the medrash records a very interesting discussion between Zeresh and Haman. So first Zeresh suggested different things. She said, maybe we should throw him into a furnace. So Haman said, that's a good idea. Zeresh said, no, I don't think so. It doesn't work for the Jews. Because Nimrod, Zeresh comes out from here. Zeresh was a very, very knowledgeable woman. Right? According to this medrash. She knew a lot of stuff about Judaism and about Jewish ideas. So she said, no, that's not going to work because Nimrod threw Avram into a furnace and he wasn't burnt at all. So that's not going to work. Right? And the same thing happened in Nebuchadnezzar's time. Nebuchadnezzar threw three people, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, into a furnace. They also were saved. So that's not good. So maybe we can stab him to death, right? He says, oh, good idea. No, and she thinks, no, also not a good idea. Why? Yitzchak survived the knife at the Akedah. So he was threatened with a knife. The Jews have a way of getting out of this. And also Moshe Rabbeinu was caught in Egypt after he killed the Egyptian. He was taken to Paro, according to the Medrash. Why did he flee to Haman? According to the Medrash, According to the Medrash, he didn't just flee to Midian. He was first caught, and he was going to be executed. And as the executioner took the sword to cut off his neck turned to marble. That's what the Medrash tells us. And then they all became deaf mute, and he was able to run away. Or paralyzed, whatever the Medrash, I've forgotten exactly what the Medrash says. And he fled to Midian, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not a good idea. Okay, maybe we can just put him in a dungeon and throw away the key kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So she says, no, also not a good idea, because Yosef was thrown into prison. Also supposed to rot in prison, but it was released and became the prime minister, like you, like Haman, you know. So maybe we can burn him, roast him, and call something. She says, no, that's not going to work, because the Babylonians tried that to a person called Menashe, also didn't work. Oh, then they came up with an idea, maybe they should throw him into a lion's den. Well, that's for sure not going to work, because it wasn't just before the Purim story that Daniel was thrown into a lion's den, and he was saved. So then she says, I don't know of any historic thing with the Jews that someone was saved from the gallows. So it looks like the only method that we're able to do is a gallows. Right? And that's why she suggested the gallows, not knowing, of course, that she would add to the historic story and this would become another thing that the Jew was able to be saved from. Okay. Now, that's one reason. There are other reasons. The Monos Halevi. Monos Halevi is a very, very famous commentary in the Megillah. Just so you know, it was written by Reb Shlomo Alkavetz, the author of the Lachadodi, right? Who was the author of this Sefer also. That's why it's called Monos Halevi. Just to give you background, interesting story. First of all, if you look at the Lachadodi from, not the chorus, Lachadodi, but from the first paragraph, you'll notice that the letters that begin each paragraph make up Shlomo Halevi. Because he was a Levi, right? So he wrote his Shlomo Halevi, and Adal Chadudi. Then the story goes, he was a very, very great Torah giant. And he, when he was engaged, he was also very, very poor, to the point that he wasn't able to send Mishlach Manot to his father-in-law. He was engaged and was Purim, and obviously the right thing would be to do to send Mishlach Manot. Manot means foods, right? Presents, food presents. And he couldn't even afford it. So he wrote a sefer instead. He wrote a sefer on the Megillah, commentary on the Megillah, and he called it Manot Halevi. So Manot after Mishlach Manot, and Halevi because he's a Levi, right? So he sent it to his father-in-law, and we have the sefer today. So he says that we find that was a very simple reason. He just explains the pshat. He says the reason she wanted him hanged because there was the Persian style that anyone who transgressed or went against the king's laws would be punished by hanging with the gallows, because we find this just before in the Megillah, the story of the two people, Bigson and Seresh, right? Bigson and Seresh, who Mordechai overheard that they were going to poison the king. He overheard it because they were speaking in a language which they thought he didn't understand. He did understand it, and he reported it to the king through Esther, and they were hanged. And they were hung. Hung? Hanged? Hanged.
Yes.
Right. Okay. The Vilna Gaon says a simple reason why she chose gallows. The Vilna Gaon, the Gra on his Pirush on Esther, he said she just wanted to see. She wanted to have the satisfaction of seeing him after he was punished. So the best way is hanging, because then everyone can look, right? So she wanted to be public. The Manas HaLevi, also going back to the Manas HaLevi, brings another pshat, and she says it also was Midah Keneged Midah. It was also revenge on Mordechai. They were not happy that Mordechai was responsible for having Bigson and Seresh killed. With all kinds of midrashim, the truth is Haman had his eye on the throne eventually, right? So in fact, he was quite happy about the plot that Bigson and Seresh were going to poison the king. And he was unhappy with Mordechai that he had Bigson and Seresh killed. They were hung, so therefore he decided that he will also have Mordechai go on the gallows as well. Okay, so that's in terms of hanging. Now, an interesting thing she says in the pasuk, I'm just going through a few different things in this pasuk before we go into a much bigger issue. So if you look at the language of the pasuk, she said, build an eitz of 50 amas high. But the 50 amas high is absolutely huge. You know that, by the way. It's about 25 meters high. Amas is about half a meter. Right? So that's huge gallows. Right? There's a medrash, by the way, which I as heard it as a kid. I thought it was a Purim joke. But actually, it's a real medrash. That he couldn't find wood. Where's he going to find wood that tall? Right? And one of his sons lived in an area where the remains of the ark, of Noach's ark, was. So he took a piece of wood from the teva, because that was 50 amos long, right? 50 amos wide, actually. And that's where he got the wood from. Anyway, but then she says, Uba boiker, go very early in the morning and tell the king this is what we're going to do, right? So why did she want this done early in the morning? What was the emphasis on having it done early in the morning? So in the Medrash it says, again, she was knowledgeable. She says she wanted Mordechai hung before the Jews get up to read Shema. Why? Because the Yaros Tvash from Yonis and Eibitschis explains the Gemara and says, the Gemara says that if someone reads Shema in its right time in the morning, they won't get harmed that day. They read it with the proper kavana. So therefore, she wanted Mordechai hung before he gets a chance to read Shema. So that he shouldn't have that schus, and he should be able to be hung on the gallows, right? Once again, the Vilna Gaon explains, Pshat, he says, just because he didn't want the whole commotion. He wanted to get it done early in the morning. Filibuster this way. In other words, you want to just go and tell Mordechai she's doing it and get it done before any, because don't forget, Mordechai was a big guy. Mordechai had connections in the government, so he didn't want anyone coming or getting up and hearing what's going on and rushing to the king to defend Mordechai's case, right? So therefore he decided, no, we're just gonna push it through. The Malbim explains that the derech was, whenever someone got punished, they would hang people in the morning, because they wanted to make an example out of them. So when people would get up and go to work and start to do their daily things, they would right away see it. It was always very public. They would see it and learn a lesson, and they would be affected by that, right? Now, another little interesting thing in the Pasuk, just have a look back to the Pasuk, right? When Zeresh said, she said, Ya'asu Eitz, let a gallows be made. She didn't mean that Haman should make it, right? But then later it says, the last two words of the chapter, it says, Vayitav Hadovar Lifnei Haman. This was really, Haman thought this was a great idea. The suggestion pleased him. Vayasu Eitz, and he made the gallows, right? Interesting, I just noticed that the article translates it different. It says, the suggestion pleased Haman, and he had the gallows erected. Now, I guess they're just following Reb Pshat, because obviously he wasn't going to do it, and also there wasn't Zeresh's suggestion. His suggestion was, have it made. Ya'asu, let them make it, meaning servants or whatever, right? But then it says, Vayas Eitz. Not everyone learns Pshat like the article. It's amazing how translation can create problems. Everything, things get lost in translation, right? So they've translated, obviously, according to one particular way of learning the Pasuk, but not everyone learns like that. So in many places, they learn that, no, Vayas Eitz, actually what happened was she suggested that someone else should make it, but he went and made it. Why? The Al-Shuk says, this is the Pshat that we say, Sino mekalkeles hashura, that the Sino, hatred, can completely disrupt routine order and logic, right? Because he was so enthusiastic and he was so excited, and he was so excited about having Mordechai hung in the morning that he wasn't going to trust anyone. And he went all night himself and erected this gallows. Vayaseis, right? Alternatively, the Shemin Hamorah, another Pirush in the Megillah, says the reason that it himself is he needed to be kept secret. I mean, once it was up, obviously it wasn't very secret, but he didn't want to involve too many people because he didn't want to disrupt his plan. Okay. Now comes the question like this. What was the intent? Right? So I'm going to give you a few short ones and one long one. What was the intention of building a gallows that was 50 amas high? Why 50 amas? Right? So the Targum says that people should see, should be very public. The Yalkut, the Midrash says that it was actually, you know, sometimes Hashem makes people do things even though they don't know why they're doing things. So Hashem made them do it because eventually this gallows was used not only for Haman, it was used for Haman and all his 10 sons. That's what needs to be so big, right? The Maharal explains like this. Maharal says that what they used to do is that the more important the person was, the higher they would make the gallows. And Haman wanted to Dafka make it very, very high, so people should see that he managed to punish even someone who's so important. So that was emphasizing how important Mordechai was, and yet he was able to punish him. Right? Rabbi Yitzchak Avigdor, I'm not even sure what that is, he says, very interesting thing, he says that he made it very, very high, because in olden times, I think this was still not so, even historically, it was a well-known thing, this. But in ancient times, for sure, if they punished someone by hanging, the law was that in case the rope broke, they become innocent. They get off the punishment, right? So he wanted to make sure that if something goes wrong and the rope breaks, Mordechai should anyways die. Because if he falls from 50 amas high, it's not going to survive anyway. So that was the reason he made it so high. And so on and so forth. Okay, now, however, there's a much, much deeper pshat in all this, in why it's 50 amas, and I'm going to share with you an explanation. The explanation, I'll tell you where it comes from. It's something I learned this year. Actually, it comes from a discourse that the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, spoke in 1958. It was a very, very famous Purim. It's known in the Chabad Sokh, it's known as Purim Toshin Chai. Where the Rebbe had a Purim for Brengen that he started at 9:30 at night and he went all the way till 6:30 the next morning. And there were very, very deep things all night, even though the story goes, he said a lot of l'chaim that night, as people do on Purim. But the more l'chaim it took, the deeper the Torah got. That's by tzaddikim how it works, right? And he said a very, very deep mimer, a very deep discourse on Purim, in which he explained the whole thing with the gallows, and based on a very, very beautiful medrash, a few medrashim, and why specifically it was 50 amas, and why ultimately it didn't work, and there was a transformation. Okay. So just by way of introduction, something we spoke about many, many times. So one very, very important thing to understand about the Megillah is this, that the Megillah needs to be read on multiple levels. Now, this is not just a Kabbalistic thing, this is a very famous thing. There's a a very famous minhag that people have, and lots of different communities have this minhag, that when they write Megillus, when they write the Megillah scroll, right, they do it in such a way, you know, the word Hamelech, the king, comes up a lot in the Megillah, correct? So many, many people have minhag, when they write the Megillah, they make sure that, except for the first column and one other one, that every column should actually start with the word Hamelech. You just rearrange the letters in such a way, the font in such a way, that every column should start with Hamelech. It's called an Hamelech Megillah. Why do they do that? Why do we want to start every column with Ahasuerus? Right? What's the point? The answer is because the Megillah actually operates on many layers, but two layers specifically. One is the story, how the Megillah plays out in this world, and one, how the exact same story is being played out in Shammai. Because don't forget, Haman would never be able to make a decree if the forces of Tumah, the forces of evil, the forces against Yiddishkeit or against Kedusha, wouldn't be able to have strength in Shammai, right? So therefore, there's a whole nother story to the Megillah which is happening at the same time. So when the Melech, when the king agrees to Haman that this Gezeirah could be implemented, HaMelech is the Hashem. Hashem is agreeing to it, right? So just to give you a little bit of a synopsis, so whenever it says HaMelech in the Megillah, it's actually referring to Hashem as well. Whenever it says Esther is a symbol of a Jew, but a Jew that the neshama and the spiritual consciousness is very hidden, right? Mordechai, on the other hand, is also the Jew. I mean, this is just one explanation, many explanations, but Mordechai is the tzaddik who works to reveal the neshama of the Yid. So Mordechai is then facilitates the tshuva, the return, the revelation of Jewishness. So Esther was a symbol of the whole Jewish nation, not just Esther. Esther was all the Jewish people. Jewish people then were in a context of Hester Panim. They were hidden, meaning Hashem was hidden from them. They were hidden from Hashem. Their Jewishness was hidden, which is why they assimilated and why they became so part of the culture. But through Mordechai's effort in the story of Purim, Mordechai ignited that neshama once again and it revealed, right? Haman, of course, represents the forces of evil, right? Now, we know this in many different ways. First of all, Haman came from Amalek, right? Amalek, we know from this coming Shabbos, is what we know as Parsha Zachor. It's the Parsha, we remember the mitzvah of destroying Amalek. Because Amalek is not just a physical country, Amalek is actually a spiritual problem, and it's the root of all evil. We have different nations represent evil, but Amalek represents the root of evil, right? And we know, interestingly enough, that Haman is also rooted and connected with the very source and origin of failing and sin. Why? The Gemara says, right? The Gemara says, Haman mina Torah minayin. Where does Haman come from in the Torah? Where's Haman hinted in the Torah? Right? I once gave a whole shiur on this. We're not going to go that route now, but just to highlight this concept. So the Gemara says, where's Haman rooted in the Torah, hinted in the Torah? So the Gemara says, Haman is hinted with the sin of the fruit. Because when Hashem said to Adam and Chava, Hamin ha'etz hazeh, did you eat that specific type of fruit that I told you not to eat? Hamin is the same letters as Haman. Okay? Now, what that means is interesting. So same letters, so what? But what one of the concepts is, that means Haman is rooted in the original sin, which leads the Mefarshim to explain that Haman symbolized what we call in Kabbalah the Nochash HaKadmoini, the original snake. Because when Hashem created the world, He created the forces of evil, right? But before the sin of Eitz Hadas, all evil was encapsulated in one being. It was external from the person. We didn't have the Eitz Hara internally. All evil was outside, everything else was good. There was a complete separation between good and evil. And where was evil? Evil was encapsulated and embodied in the snake, right? So that's why a snake is always a symbol of complete evil. And therefore, Haman is symbolic of the Nachash HaKadmoni. Amalek, first of all, and then Haman. It's all about absolute evil, the forces of evil that try to bring down the forces of holiness. Okay? So that's the players of the Megillah. Esther, Mordechai, the Yid, Ahasuerus, Hashem, Hamelech, and Haman. Okay. Now, oh, sorry, I forgot that I actually copied that pasuk. So look at your handout. So the first pasuk, number one, is that pasuk that where Haman is hinted, right? Which says, Hashem said, "Mihi gidlacha ki eramato." How do you know you're naked? Hamin ha'etz. Did you eat from that fruit that I told you not to eat from? You see the word Hamin there? That's Haman. Okay. Now we're going to go on a journey. Okay, you ready? So I need to give you background now. So the background was like this. So we're completely digressing and we're going to come back. Last week's parasha, Truma, we read... I don't know if I can just show it to you quickly, sir. 1 minute. Let's just give me a second here. It'll be easy if you see this visually. Oh, very good. Go to page 457. Yep. Now, I'll tell you the relevance of the picture in a minute. When they built the Mishkan, they built it with these beams, with the big pillars, right? Now, how are the pillars connected? So if you look at that picture, they were connected with what the Chumash refers to as briach. Briach means like a bolt, right? Like wooden bolts, like wooden poles that connected the two grashim. So there were three such poles. If you look at that picture, you see the one on the outside, on top and on the bottom. So the crushing, the beams of the Mishkan had little rings attached to them. And these poles went through the rings, connecting the crushing, holding it up strong, right? With me? Then we had what's called, what the Chumash calls, the Habriach HaTichoin. Right? Which was called the middle bar. Okay? You see in that picture, going through the middle, inside? Right, so what happened was they drilled holes, I guess, inside the beams, right? And the pole went through the middle and held it together that way. Now, the Pasuk says, have a look at number 2 on your handout. It says, V'habriya chatichoin, the central bar, right? B'soich hakroshim, which went in the beams, mavriach min hakotze el hakotze. Extended from one end to the other. Now, there's a machloek is what this means, but I'm just going to give you one of the I think Targum's interpretation and others, that actually this was a miraculous thing. Meaning, some learned that there were actually three middle beams. There was a beam that went through the middle on the one side, the other side, and then the right, because the Mishkan was built three sides. It was sort of open, more or less open in the fourth, but it was built three sides. So you had three beams that went to the middle, one, this side, one. But there's another Pirush that actually this was a miraculous event. It was only one beam, which obviously is impossible to put through everything, but it was miraculous. It swirled around. Miraculously, it was a beam of wood, but it went into the Mishkan through the middle and came all the way around. Right? Targum says, he translated, what does it mean it swirled all the way around? Miraculously, he said it went through the Mishkan ka'achno, like a snake. Okay, you can already see the connection, a snake, but we'll come to it much later. So that's what Targum says. We need to know, why does he use the imagery of a snake? Okay. So now the question is, where did this beam come from, this pole that they put? That means it was a very, very long wooden pole. Where did it come from? Right? So go to the next pasuk. A fascinating thing. If we put a few midrashim together, there's a fascinating picture. One is like this. Next pasuk, number 3, talks about when Yaakov and his family went down to Mitzrayim. And he knew there was going to be a long business. He didn't know how long, but he knew it was going to be long. Hashem encouraged him to go. He says, don't worry, I'll go with you and I'll come back with you. And Yaakov says the Midrash foresaw that the Yidden were going to need a Mishkan eventually. Right? So it says, Vayisa Yisrael v'chol asher lo'i. Yisrael and everything, meaning Yaakov and everything, all his family and everything they had, they traveled. And on their way to Mitzrayim, Vayovei Be'eiro Sheva, they came to Be'eir Sheva. Why did they go to Be'eir Sheva? Heichon holach, where did he go, says the Medrash. Amar Rav Nachman says, Sheholach lokutz arozim, Shenota Avram zekenoi. He went to cut down cedar branches that his grandfather Avram Avinu had cut down, Be'er Sheva, which was in the city of Be'er Sheva. Now, what cedar branch is he referring to? Go to the next pasuk. Remember when the three angels came to Avram Avinu? Right? So he asked, he invited them in, he said, please, yukach na ma'at maim, take some water, it's number four. V'rachatzu raglechem, and wash your feet. V'hisha'anu tachas ha'etz, and rest under the tree. What's the tree? Why does it say rest under a tree? Why the tree? So Chazal tell us that that tree that Avraham Avinu planted wasn't just some tree, it was a specific tree. It's a tree which was referred to in the pasuk. What tree was that? So it's another pasuk in Bereishis, a famous pasuk. It says that Avraham Avinu moved to Be'er Sheva, and it says, number five, Vayita Eishel b'Be'er Sheva. Avraham Avinu planted an Eishel in Be'er Sheva. Vayikra Shom b'Shem Hashem Keil Olam, and he called the name of Hashem. Now, what does Eishel mean? So we know that Eishel, some say, actually does not mean a tree. Some say Eishel means a pundak, an inn. Because the word Eishel is an acronym for Achila Shtia Lino. Eating, drinking, and sleeping. Or Achila Shtia and Levia. Or eating, drinking, and accompanying them after. It was a hospitality joint, right? So Avraham Avinu set up a whole hospitality center. Because he was like that, right? But some say, no, Vayita Eishel, he planted an Eishel. Eishel was a tree. Which the Torah refers to as Eishel. And that's significant, as we'll see later, okay? So, let's draw a picture there. Let's just get a picture straight here. Avraham Avinu plants a special tree called the Eishel. That's the tree he asks the Malachim to recline under, right? That's the tree, or branches from that tree, that Yaakov Avinu takes down to Mitzrayim. And by the way, that's a very, very famous thing. That's what part of what the Medrash says. That's what kept the Yidden's Emunah going the whole time they were in Mitzrayim. They knew that one day they're going to be redeemed. Because Yaakov Avinu, what did he bring those things for you? What did he take those? They always had those cedar branches. Because they knew that they're going to be redeemed. They're going to need them. They need them on the way. They're going to have to go and build a Mishkan. Right? Okay. So that's the tree that Yaakov takes. Now, that's also the tree which we read about in a few weeks ago in Parshas B'Shalach. Have a look at number six. Right? I don't know if you know, when the Yidden came out of Mitzrayim, they came to a place called Morah, where the water was very bitter, and they started to complain. So it says there, Vayitzak al Hashem, and Moshe Rabbeinu called out to Hashem, Vayiro Hashem Eitz, and Hashem showed him a piece of wood. Vayashlech el Hamayim, and he threw the wood into the water. He dipped it into the water. Vayimtaku Hamayim, and the water became sweet. It transferred it, transformed it from bitter waters to sweet waters. Okay? Now, so you got the picture? So it's a tree that Avraham Avinu plants. That's the Malachim Yaakov Avinu takes down to Mitzrayim. That's the one that Moshe Rabbeinu put into the water. And that became the pole, that became this miraculous pole that went through the whole Mishkan miraculously and swirled around like a snake. Okay. Now, why am I telling you all this? Because there's a medrash that says like this, which I didn't copy, I'm sorry. The medrash says that when Zeresh said to Haman, Ya'asu eitz govoya chamishim amo, go and make a wood, a gallows, that is 50 amas high. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, this wood is not going to work for you. Why? Because there's another wood which preceded your wood. What's the wood that preceded your wood? V'hishanu tachas ha'etz. When Avraham Avinu said that they will recline under the tree, that original tree is stronger than your tree. That tree that Avraham Avinu invited the guests under, and that tree that Avraham Avinu, that Yaakov Avinu took down to Mitzrayim, and that Moshe Rabbeinu put in the water, and then eventually Yidden put into the Mishkan, became the miraculous tree that swirled around like a snake, says Hashem, that tree, that eitz, that piece of wood, is much stronger than your wood, and therefore it's not going to succeed. That's the message. So what does all that mean? Right? What does all that mean? Why is that tree stronger than his tree? Why is it stronger than history? What's the significance of 50 amos? And so on. So here comes the explanation. So, in Kabbalah there's a discussion about the forces of klipa, the forces of impurity that Hashem created in the world. Everything in this world, nothing can be created outside of Hashem giving it sustenance, chayas, life force, energy. We don't believe in anything existing outside of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? That's Shal Hashem Echa. Not like other religions that believe there's different forces, the forces of good and the forces of that. We don't believe in that, right? So even the forces of total tumah, of total impurity, which Hashem by design made the world with in order to test us, whatever the reason was, right? Those forces of klipa exist. They're the opposition to Hashem, but they're being kept alive by Hashem, right? So how do they keep alive? So many Sfarim explain, Hashem gives them just enough divine energy to exist, but not enough to feel it, which is why they end up being the forces that actually oppose Hashem and influence and resist Kedusha and fight all matters of holiness and fight Yiddishkeit and fight Kedusha and fight Hashem and so on and so forth, right? In other words, the more Kedusha Hashem gives into someone, the bigger the dose of divine life, divine energy, the closer the person comes to Yiddishkeit. That's why we have things that are treif, things that are kosher, and then Kedusha, things that are complete Kedusha and things like that, right? So it all got to do with the level of divine connection. Klipa, as we know, klipa meaning the forces of evil, exist, and if they exist, they must have some nourishment from divine energy, but obviously it's very, very minimal, just enough that they'll be able to exist, right? Because of that, there's a constant desire, Kabbalah explains, in the world of Tumah, in the world of the evil forces, to constantly try and become stronger and stronger all the time, because they're not operating on much, so therefore they always need more. How do they get more? So here comes a very, very important idea. When Hashem created the world, so to use the Hasidic terminology, there's a system which Hashem created the world with called Seder Hishtalshlus. It's the system of order, meaning not just this world, it's higher world as well, the world's known as Bri, it's Sira Si, and so on. It's the spiritual worlds, godly worlds, angels, all kinds of things, all based on the 10 utterances which Hashem created the world, which are connected to the 10 tools of creation, Chacham and Adas, Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes, and so on and so forth. And it's a system that Hashem created. It's a system of logic, it's a system of order, it's a system of rationale, where things make sense, where there's a cause and effect, where things happen, cause other things to happen, and so on and so forth, right? Within that system, there's a system of good and evil, a system of morality and immorality, a system of right and wrong, right? But you have to understand, it's an interesting thing with this, right? That when we talk about something being right and wrong, a lot of times the difference between right and wrong is to us, we say, yeah, this is for sure wrong, this is for sure right. How do we know? But it might be logically something might be logically right and logically wrong, or logically moral, logically immoral, right? But really, that's because Hashem made it that way. That's a creation itself from Hashem. Hashem created the logic. Correct? Why am I saying this? There's a very interesting pasuk. I've forgotten exactly where it is, in Tanakh somewhere, right? Which says that Hashem actually doesn't care. We don't affect Hashem if we do something right, do something wrong, right? The pasuk words is im tzodakto matitin lo, if you did righteousness, what did you give Hashem? If you have lots of avarice, you're not really affecting him, right? Why? Because there is a level where Hashem transcends this order, right? He created the order. He created the system. He created the logic which operates within the system where everything seems to make sense to us, and there's good and evil. When you do evil, you get punished. When you do good, you get rewarded, and so on and so forth. But that's only within the system, right? Hashem in his true infinity, Hashem created the system because he wanted that system, that's correct, but it's almost a lowering of Hashem. In other words, always he chose to manifest himself in a sort of a very finite, almost rigid system, right? But really Hashem, as he transcends that system, really good and evil is quite equal, right? There's even a pasuk in Tanakh where it says, Hale'och Esav le'Yaakov. Esau is a brother to Yaakov. Meaning Esau, Yaakov. Okay, Hashem ends up choosing Yaakov. We'll get to that in a second. But there's a level, there's a madrega, so to speak, where Esau and Yaakov are all the same. It doesn't make a difference. Now, So we are taught like this. What happens is as follows. When the system works, meaning when we adhere to the system which Hashem wanted, right? And we adhere to good and we reject evil, in other words, we make the system work, then the system is the operating system of the universe, right? Which means that Kedusha becomes very strong, Tumah, impurity, the forces of evil become very weak, and they're not able to oppose, they're not able to stand up, they're not able to be strengthened, right? However, when we, as Yidden, break the system, when we go against the system, when we muddle up the whole good and evil within the system, within what we call Seder Ishtalshalos, yeah, then the system is broken. If the system is broken, then we are taught what the forces of evil are able to do. They're able then to bypass the system and tune into, click into higher than the system and get whatever they want from there. Because when you bypass the system, higher than the system, good and evil is the same. Okay? Am I making sense? It's deep in you. Yeah? Okay. And that's what Haman attempted to do. He made a mistake, we'll soon see. That's what Haman attempted to do. Why? There's two very significant parts of the Purim story where we see this is what Haman was trying. Now, I don't know if Haman was a Kabbalist or not, I don't know. And I'm not sure if this is a conscious thing that Haman was thinking or not. But don't forget, the Megillah happens on two stories, on two layers, right? So if it's Haman just being guided to do it like that, or Haman consciously wanted to do that, I don't know. But what Haman symbolized at least wanted to do that. The forces of evil wanted to do this. One is that he says, let's make, or Zeresh says, or advises him, let's make a gallows of 50 amos. So that's exactly this is exactly what he wanted to do. The system that Hashem made, in which he created the world, one of the numbers that it's that represents the completion of the system is 49. Why? Because the way Hashem relates to us is through the seven midas, right? Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and so on. Each one of the seven midas interact with the other seven, so it's seven times seven, like when we count the Omer, right? So seven times seven is the perfection of the world. It's a perfection of order. It's a perfection of the system of order which Hashem created, known as Seder Ishtalshalos. And that's why we are taught that we cannot even reach the 50th system on our own, because that's beyond us, beyond even the perfection of the order, right? So Haman figures they're messing up the system. So now I've got a chance to get into the 50th gate. Because when the system doesn't work, then you can go straight to higher than the system. And higher than the system, I can flourish. It's above logic. It's the system of randomness. It's a system of chaos, a system where nothing makes sense. Good, evil, it's all the same. Why is it all the same? Because really it's actually representing a very high level, but it's a high level where Hashem transcends his system, his logic of good and evil, and therefore Yaakov is his brother to Esav. Good and evil is the same. If you do our various mitzvahs, it all doesn't matter. Right? That's why he wants to build a gallows of 50 amos. Yeah? That's also why he drew lots, and that's why Purim is called Purim, which means lots. What was the idea of drawing lots? Same idea, we are taught. What is lots? Lots is the way you make something happen that doesn't make sense. It's random. There's no logic to it. This month, that month, right? He drew lots because that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to enter the world of the super-rational. The world that transcends logic. The world that transcends the system of order. That's why he wanted a gallows of 50 amos. What was his mistake? Exactly where he tried to krich, as they say in Yiddish, exactly where he tried to go, that's where his mapola came from. Because what he didn't understand is that there's three levels. There's a system of order. There's what's above order. And then there's what we call the essence of Hashem. In other words, like this. We call Bechira. A little bit of an analogy from a person is it works like this, right? It's not exactly the same thing, but it's a little bit so we can make it clear. In other words, like this. Sometimes I do something because it just makes sense, right? It makes sense I'm doing it. Sometimes I'm not in a sensical mood, so I'll just do things that don't make sense. So I'll do things that are destructive, right? Doesn't make a difference. But then there's sometimes I'll do something that might make sense, but I'm not doing it because it makes sense. I'm doing it because it's really who I am. It goes to the very deepest part of who I am. A little bit of an example of it maybe is like unconditional to a love of a child, for example, right? So you might be very nice to your child because it might make sense because he's acting well, right? Sometimes when that doesn't go well, so then we don't have it, so the relationship is broken. But ultimately, if a parent really wants to reconnect, what do? They dig into a place in their soul where they love the child, not because the child's better, not because the child's done good, but because it's his child. It's very deep, right? Same thing with the Yidden. The pasuk that I quoted you before that says, "Haloi och Esav leYaakov," right? That Esav was a brother to Yaakov. What's the continuation of that pasuk? It's a very interesting pasuk. The pasuk says, "Esav is a brother to Yaakov," right? But I love Yaakov and I hate Esav. That's what it says in the pasuk. So why do you say it's a brother? What the pasuk is saying is like this: Yidden are supposed to do good. Yidden are supposed to follow the system. Why? Because that's the mission of the world. Hashem really wants there to be good in the world. In other words, He created the system of logic that really wants to happen. Right? In other words, Hashem in His infinite manifestation, Hashem as He is, transcends good and evil. He doesn't care on one level. He doesn't care from a logical point of view. So He created a system where it's logical to do good and it's illogical to do bad. Right? Okay. But why did He create that system? And why did He put the Yidden here? Because in His essence, for whatever reason, we don't know why, but that's what He really chose to do. That's what He wants. He wants good to happen. He wants, not because it's logical. It's logical, that's why we do it, because we need to live in a world of logic. But He chose good. Understand? He chose good. Every mitzvah, by the way, operates in those three levels. Mitzvahs, there's mitzvahs that operate where mitzvahs are clearly better than averus, logically. They bring brachos, they make sense, they, I don't know, whatever reason, you know, we eat matzah because we went out of Mitzrayim, right? Then there's mitzvahs on a level where they don't make, where actually it's illogical, like there's a medrash that says that does Hashem really care if you shecht an animal from the front or the back? It makes no difference, He just gave us mitzvahs, so we should be disciplined, because there is a level where that is true. But then there's even a deeper level that Hashem chose the mitzvahs because He wants, that's His rotzen, that's His instinctive will, that's who He is. The same thing with the Yid. Hashem wants us to operate within the system, wants us to do good. And if we don't do good, there's a consequence. And if we don't do good, it gives rise for the system to break down, and it gives rise for the clipper, for the forces of evil to tap into the 50th gate. To tap in the level of godliness, level of godly revelation, where good and evil is all equal, and they can become very strong there. However, we can defeat that. How we can defeat that? What the Yidden did in the time of Purim, they did tshuva. How do you do tshuva? If you broke the system, you broke the system, right? Because very, very deep down, there's a relationship between us and Hashem that's got nothing to do with logic. It's got nothing to do even with Torah mitzvahs. It's essential, it's inherent, it's intrinsic. It's Hashem chose the Jewish people. In other words, in the world of irrational, you get even a deeper irrational. That Hashem chose specifically one thing, not for a reason, because that's Him. And He chose the Yidden. However, you have to reveal that. How do you reveal that? You reveal that by revealing the same thing within us. We also have the same kind of levels in us, right? So we know, we've talked about this many times, we have five levels of the neshama, right? What's the deepest level of the neshama? The yichida, the fifth level, the pinta leyid. That deep, if we we do on Yom Kippur, we have five davenings. Why? Because Yom Kippur we do tshuva. Because we arouse that fifth level, the yechidah of the nefesh, the essence of the soul. That essence of the soul talks directly to the essence of Hashem. So when you break the system, you give rise for the world of irrational. When you reveal the essence of the neshama connecting the essence of Hashem, you destroy the irrational. And you reveal Hashem's real love for the Yidden. Oh. So that's what happened now. Hashem said, we're not going to have time to fully explain this, but we'll just explain the point. Hashem said, you're trying to build a wood, you're trying to build a gallows. What are you trying to do? You're trying to reach the 50th level. Where do you come from? You come from the world of logic, right? So you're thinking that logic is broken down, so you can go to the fifth gate. Why? Because where's Haman rooted in the Torah? But the original sin. And that's exactly right. So you work with sin, good, evil, they're sinning, so therefore you can get in. That's the whole Medrash. The Gemara says that he told Ahasuerus, Yeshnei Amechad, there's a nation, which means Yoshim and Amitzah, the Eden have fallen asleep, they're not keeping Mitzvah, they've assimilated, they're fine, we can take care of them. That's what he thought he could take care of Mordechai also. So therefore, the system is broken down. I saw the original sin, I was there, I got Adam and Chava to sin, I got them to sin now. We're doing well. We're getting them to break the whole system. Once we got them to the whole break system, I can go to Sharanun, I can go to the 50th gate. Right? He says, Hashem, no, you can't. Because he's not doing tshuva. And therefore, their wood preceded your wood. What is their wood? Their wood is that piece of wood I described to you before. Where does it come from? It comes from Avraham Avinu's wood. Vayita Eshel. That Avraham Avinu planted an Eshel. Eshel is an acronym. And this is where we don't have time to actually explain this, but let me try to get it in. Can I go just 2 minutes late? Is that right? Yeah? Oh, that clock's a bit fast anyways. Okay. Eshel starts with an Aleph. Aleph stands for, the word Aleph is Aleph Lamed Fei. Aleph Lamed Fei starts with Pele. Pele means wondrous, miraculous, deep, way beyond logic. Avraham Avinu also transcended the order of things, but went much deeper than you. Avraham Avinu transcended the whole concept of creation also. Avraham Avinu revealed the Jewish soul at its very, very deepest level. And Avraham Avinu brought down and revealed the Aleph, the Pele, the wonder of existence, which is the deepest and most irrational and super-rational, I should say, connection between Hashem and the Jewish people, which can never be broken. Which that Aleph is connected with the Aseres HaDibros, because when Hashem created the world, we know He started with Beis. Because Beis starts with Bracha, it says, which is right, because Hashem created a beautiful world. But why didn't He start with Aleph? According to Kabbalah, He didn't start with Aleph because Aleph is way beyond creation. Even the infinite, it's the essence of Hashem. Onoichi Hashem Alekecha. When it came Matan Torah, Hashem started with an Aleph. I am Hashem, your God. And we are taught, what does it mean, Onoichi? Onoichi means, like Elokecha is the name of Elohim. It represents the creation, the order, the creation where Hashem is finite. Hashem, Yudke Vavke, represents the infinite, which is above Hishtalshlus, above the order. And Onoichi is Hashem's essence. Onoichi Hashem Lakecha. That's the Eishel of Avraham Avinu. The revealing of the Jewish soul, which at its deepest level, at its fifth level, connects with the essence of Hashem and can never be broken. It just needs to be ignited. And it needs to be ignited on three levels. And I'll just briefly explain this to you. It needs to be lighted on Eshel. Aleph, another at the concept. Aleph, there's a pasuk that says, Aleph also stands for A'alefcha, I will teach you. I will think, I will teach you. Chachma Alefcha Bino. There's a pasuk that says, A'alefcha, Chachma Alefcha Bino. I will teach you. Chachma Alefcha Bino, which means that once we reveal that deepest connection, then we have to take that connection and then rebuild our whole structure. Number one, our seichel, our being. The shin, which is the three primary emotions. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes. The shin has three things. And the Lamed, which stands for instruct, Lamed, to instruct, which then inspires how we act. So the Yidden went back on Purim and they davened and they reconnected to Hashem in such a way that they revealed, they went back to the original, not the wood of Haman, they went back to the wood of Avraham Avinu, which is deeper. They went back to the Eshel. They revealed the very essential connection that they had between them and Hashem. That is the connection, by the way, that can transform any bad to good. It can repair any problem and transform it. That's why that was the one that made the bitter water sweet in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu when he put that wood into the water. That was the wood that went around the Mishkan like a snake, because that's the wood, that's the connection that can even transform the snake. It can beat the snake. It can take the snake and make it part of the Mishkan. That's why Targum says that wood went around like a snake, and therefore that's the wood that is going to stand them in good stead now and beat Haman, even when Haman tries to reach the 50th gate. And that's why Hashem says, don't try your wood, because their wood comes first. Their wood is deeper than your wood. You go one level above the system. They go to the essence of Hashem. You went to Nun, they go to Pele, Anoichi Hashem Alekecha. And that level, you finish. That level, so in other words, the very place where Haman was, as it says many places, the very place where Haman was trying to explore, which is the world of the super-rational, Hashem says, you want to explore that, you go deeper in that level, you'll find a connection between Hashem and the Eden that is unbreakable. And that's why Purim is such a deep day, because that concept of tshuva and the tshuva that was done on Purim, actually, you see, when you're not always doing the right thing, sometimes that deepest level doesn't be revealed, because we're just working well in the order of things. But when the system is broken and Haman tries to krich to the nun, to the 50th gate, and then the Yidden reveal the ultimate connection between Hashem and the Yidden, that's a powerful day, and that's what Purim is, like Yom Kippur, even higher than Yom Kippur in a way, where it reveals that unbelievably deep connection between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. Yeah, that's a deep idea.
Well, I can say as well. Give all this.